This episode of Bend the Knee is brought to you by our bannermen, Lord Jason of House Ross, Sir Jimmy of House Nuts, Master of the Web, Lady Dawn of House Wright, Sir Chris of House Farber, Lady Tracy of House Faw, Sir Peter of House Whittingham, Sandy the Dragon, Blood of Queen Daenerys and Lady of Jameson, Lord John of House Fry, Lady Juliana of House Stradley, Sir David of House Fraser, Lady Liz of House Hendricks, Sir Matthew of House Perry, Lady Madeline of House Fritzel, Lady Adrian of House Dillard, Lady Ashley of House Gardner, Lady Lismelin of House Morales.
This episode of Bend the Knee is protected by Sir Ryan of House Turbush, Lady Sarah the Unraveler.
Our current champion is Lady Kira of House Arnold.
Our current Master of Coin is Lord Jason of House Ross.
Squire to Sir Matt, Lady Betsy of House Hudson.
Hello and welcome to Bend the Knee, a Song of Ice and Fire podcast. I am Sir Matt, the Bud Knight.
And I am Sir Ezra, the Watchful. Welcome to our Song of Ice and Fire book club. Today we're into Catelyn 7 of A Clash of Kings. And in our Raven, we will be talking about the Smiling Kettle Black Knight.
Yeah, Ez. You know, we were trying to search some things for Osmond Kettle Black and nothing comes up. He's like some guy that nobody talks about, really. So it's like, okay, well, we will.
And stick around,
talk,
by the way.
Talk about this guy.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Stick around by for the end of this, because I think we've got something cooking here and maybe a small Winds of Winter prediction that you guys might like. It's definitely tinfoil and rabbit hole city, but that's what we do. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, as we're going to start with a little bit of news. Now, this has somewhat something to do, I suppose, with Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire. I would argue that most people that are going to be watching this video on YouTube, as this, you know, our podcast gets turned into videos, probably not necessarily Game of Thrones fans that are going to be coming to talk about this, as we're going to talk a little bit about business and some of the business dealings, because it will affect, I think, Game of Thrones Westeros content in a great way in the future. So last night, as I've talked about this a little bit, I'm like a heavy AT&T investor, right? I like AT&T stock, got a great dividend. I'm all about it. And so I saw some of this news last night that seems like AT&T is going to be spinning out Warner Media, which is Cartoon Network, Warner Brothers, DC Comics, all that stuff, right? And they're going to be doing a merger with Discovery, right? So sort of Discovery owns like History Channel, all this stuff. And it was just kind of announced today. There's not like a ton of news on it yet. It seems like it's going to be 2022 at some point when this all goes down. AT&T is still going to own, AT&T shareholders, they said, are going to own 70% of the company, like Discovery, and people are going to own like 30%. But what this means, though, is that now you're going to have content people with Discovery, because it seems like they're going to be a little bit more the ones managing this, running this, running a content company as opposed to a telephone company running a content company, you know, if that makes sense. Yeah. So there's no news as to if it's going to merge, if they're going to be like one, if it's going to be HBO Max and Discovery gets folded in, are they just going to rebrand it? Like Paramount Plus kind of does that, where you get like, you can watch some live TV and it's kind of merged. You know, Disney has like Disney Plus, ESPN Plus and Hulu. You kind of get a pick, but you don't get all of it at once. And so, is that one way to go? I think it's super awesome. I think it's going to be really, really cool. And even as an investor, I think it's I think it's great. A lot of people are saying that it's bad news for AT&T. I don't think so. I think it's great news for Westeros and Game of Thrones, because right now what they're saying is Netflix spends roughly $17 billion on content a year to keep going, which that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for a lot of money to keep making new shows. Some work, some don't. And they said they're already saying that they're planning on doing $20 billion. Dollars. And if you're Discovery Channel and you're sort of absorbing a lot of this and you're going to be managing it and whatever it is you guys are working on, and you're going to become basically some sort of media conglomerate, Goliath, then, I mean, what's your sort of HBO crown jewel? Westeros. I mean, it's Game of Thrones. That's why people are...
House of Dragons, baby.
That's the thing. So to me, it sounds like more money for Westeros budgets. So I'm down.
Yeah, this is cool. And I think I did just a little bit of digging just to kind of, you know, figure out more about it. It seems like Discovery has that more of that global market in sports, right? Wasn't that kind of something that you were looking into a bit as well? Mm-hmm. So it seems like, you know, we're talking global stuff here. It seems like they're going bigger, right? I mean, going bigger, more. I mean, I'm all for it. You know, it is interesting. I think, and there's still not much out on all of this, but because I was asking the question, you know, is it Discovery Plus, HBO Max? That HBO Max just came out. That's just like, that's cool, right? So like, are they under one umbrella? Or are they going to be two separate, you know, apps? I mean, Netflix. I just go to Netflix. I click on Netflix, and
it's easy.
It's all there, man. You know, so but it is kind of cool.
It is all there. You just have to know what's there. That is the disadvantage to Netflix, is you have to think, like, what are the Netflix shows? Whereas, like, Disney, I'm like, I know what's there. Oh, yeah, I can go watch. As soon as I click in, oh, Star Wars, boom. Marvel, boom, I'm set. Right. Like, that's where I think Disney's got the best branding in terms of that. HBO's a little bit better because you go and you're like, oh, cool, Cartoon Network, DC Comics, stuff like that with Warner Media, essentially. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all unfolds. But I think it's cool because now the streaming service that we're going to be using a lot seems like it's about to get a lot better. And you're talking, you know, it's a Discovery, I think, owns A&E, which is where, or maybe it's AMC. Is that where Walking Dead is? That's kind of like, but they have the History Channel, so they have a lot of, the History Channel, Discovery Channel, one of Ez's other favorite shows, Oak Island.
Yeah. That's all exciting. I think that's really cool if they are merging these and you get more out of going to one thing, or even just the idea, I guess, that, they're looking at increasing the budget and really just making more awesome content. And we're hoping they dedicate a lot of that, you know, to Westeros. Looks like that's already happening, and we're just hoping it kind of continues. So it seems like good news, you know, it seems like they're going big. Like,
yeah, I think it's going to be awesome.
I got to play with the other, you know, streaming services. It's this streaming wars or whatever that's going on. For us, I think it's great. Like, we just get more cool content. Now, the thing is, you know, you want to watch Disney, you got to pay for that. There's something on Netflix you want to watch. You get a lot of hopping around and stuff. But, I would rather them kind of, you know, merge and put a lot of stuff and only have like a couple, like big three or whatever that I can just go to and get a lot of my shows there. That'd be cool. So, yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited. No, it's great. It's great, and I think it's also good that it's going to be content people running this instead of telephone people, right? Whereas it's AT&T, you know, because they're like trying to take on Verizon, not like, oh, we're trying to take on Disney and make like the best movies and the best, you know, TV show. Now you have that, so that to me says all, you know, because there's all these upcoming upcoming Westeros stuff, right?
Right.
I mean, all this stuff, and so now the people that are going to be making the high up decisions on it are going to be people who know what they're doing, as opposed to telephone people. So,
awesome. And they probably have, you know, it's the connections, it's who you know, who you're hiring to oversee those shows and do those things. I think that is important, And maybe if the people at Discovery are better at that, and we can make sure that everything is because when you allot that budget, you want, especially with House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones stuff, it's gotta land. They're putting so much money into it. And then you've got to build kind of like a Westeros verse, if you will, is what they're doing. They're seeing that what Marvel did and what some of these other, you know, like Star Wars, you're building these universes and stuff. So let's go. Let's have the Westeros verse and let's get after it.
Well, to me, it sounds like there's a lot more money coming too, which is great because Lord of the Rings show apparently has $500 million for a budget.
Right.
So
yeah,
there's a lot of money being thrown around. I want all of it. And I want the cool tie-ins. I want all these cool tie-ins, you know? Are we going to get Game of Thrones stuff on History Channel now? You know, is somebody going to come sell like a sword at Pawn Stars? And there's going to be like, let me go get an expert. And then in walks Kit Harington. He's like, all right, it looks like the real deal. You know,
dude,
right, I'll give you $3 for it. I mean, is that
right? That's what's going to happen. Yes. Yeah. Like is Forged in Fire? I don't even know if that's a part of the thing. You know, the guys that make the sword. Is that a part of the same network? I don't know.
It is. I think it's Discovery Channel, isn't it? Are we going to get the Game of Thrones Forged in Fire? That show is awesome, by the way.
Could you imagine if they did like a version of that for, I mean, that would be, maybe they already have. I think
Forged in Fire, you can watch it on Hulu. Looks like you can also watch it on Discovery Plus. It's got to be like History Channel, right? I mean,
I don't know. I think it is.
History Channel.
Is it? Okay. Cool. I mean, I love that show. So,
do we maybe get a super edited version of Game of Thrones that airs on TV? Like you know how sometimes they'll syndicate shows?
Yeah. That'd be wild. That would be wild. I don't know.
I think you could do it. I think you could probably edit. Well, I don't know.
Some episodes just got to cut out altogether.
I mean, The Walking Dead's like some of that stuff's like pretty brutal. And that guy's like that guy with the baseball bat or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'm down.
Anyway, I think it's all cool. I'm excited. And I think it's going to be awesome. It sounds like a win for us. So
yeah.
I'll take it.
Yeah.
So, okay. All right. Shall we move on to the reread here? Because I know you have a sort of a Raven theory you really want to get to here. So let's dive in to the reread. So this time we're into Catelyn 7 of A Clash of Kings, which is actually, I think, our last Catelyn chapter of the book.
Yeah, which is crazy. I mean, we are, I think by the end of this summer, we're going to be really coming to the end of Clash of Kings, and I can't wait to move forward, you know, because A Storm of Swords, I mean, everything just
it's,
you've talked about it, it's amazing, lots of cool stuff.
All right,
so yeah, here we
and
are.
Then do we do Boiled Leather? Do we do the,
I don't know,
I kind of want to, almost.
I know, I wonder what people, maybe we put it to do we,
which is, for those of you who don't know, Boiled Leather, so A Feast for Crows and A Dance of Dragons are essentially supposed to be one book. And there's many people have broken it down, and you can read it all as one. And I think you've said, Ez, that you think it makes way more sense if you do it that way.
Yeah, it's I've looked at two, because there are, if you put them side by side, the one you just mentioned, and there's another one, a feast with dragons or
a
something
feast
like
for
that.
Dragons, maybe.
Yeah, and I forget who did that. Yeah. It might even have been Brendan. What's his name? Brendan Beefish or whatever, the Reddit guy.
Beefish, the Reddit guy, yeah.
I think those guys put together like list where they said, hey, this is a really good chronological way to read it, or that this makes sense. I was reading I think it's called A Feast with Dragons, and it was cool. It really was cool, actually. When I started, I was like, wow, this is interesting. Because if you've already done a straight through read, or you've even done a point of view read on certain characters, it's just another way to go consume it, and it helps you kind of keep characters and plot points and themes, by the way, and like word choice and, oh gosh, symbols that George puts around characters. It keeps them fresh in the mind, especially when you associate them with other characters too. So it's, or regions, I guess, too.
We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. That's like still over a year away. So who knows?
We'll get
there. And then in 5 years, when Winds of Winter comes out, we'll figure that out too. But
right, yeah, it's coming in 5 years. Within 5 years,
maybe. Okay. All right. Well, as we dive into it here, Catelyn hears the celebration going on in River Run, but she sits alone with Brienne and desolate over the loss of her two young sons. The Raven arrived that morning, and Catelyn is beside herself with grief, despondent at the thought nearly all her children are dead or lost. She tells Brienne that she sent the Kingslayer a bottle of wine to loosen his tongue. She means to question him, and is perhaps contemplating having the man killed since she has so little to live for anymore. At midnight, Catelyn goes to interrogate Jaime, but asks Brienne to wait outside. Jaime mocks her at first, but eventually agrees to answer her questions if she agrees to answer his. Jaime admits to being the father to Cersei's children and to throwing Bran out the tower. However, Jaime denies sending the assassin. If I wanted your Bran dead, I would have killed him myself. Catelyn questions him about the dagger that Littlefinger claimed Tyrion had won from him. Jaime backs what Tyrion told her in the Mountains of the Moon, that he always bets on his brother and lost at that tourney. Jaime admits that King Robert mocked him with the dagger at the feast the night of the tourney, and Catelyn is dismayed that Littlefinger, who was like a brother to her once, would deceive her the way he has. Catelyn then reveals that Robb has recently taken the crag from the Westerlings and marched ever closer to Casterly Rock. Jaime then steers the conversation to what really happened to Brandon Stark and Lord Rickard at the hands of the Mad King, perhaps to absolve himself of having slain the king. Brandon was on his way to Riverrun when he learned of Lyanna's disappearance and instead went to King's Landing with a handful of friends, all sons of prominent lords, and upon entering the Red Keep, Brandon shouted for Rhaegar to come out and die. Rhaegar was not there to answer the challenge, and Aerys had Brandon and the men arrested for conspiring to murder his heir. Aerys demanded the fathers of the men come to King's Landing to answer the charges against their sons. When they came, both fathers and sons were murdered at the command of the Mad King, Aerys. With Brandon dying of strangulation, trying to reach his father, who was being burnt alive by Aerys' pyromancers. Jaime was a young member of the Kingsguard when he saw all of this, and it was Sir Gerald Hightower who told him, "You swore a vow to guard the king, not to judge him, whom everyone considered a better man than him." Jaime, now fully drunk, angrily rants that he is reviled for what he considers his finest act and begins to mock Ned Stark's honor, saying that unlike Ned, a man who fathered a bastard, he has never been unfaithful and that Ned had no right to judge him. The man who avenged his father and brother, but Catelyn has heard enough and calls for Brienne's sword. So there's a lot to unpack in this chapter. Mm-hmm. First, when we're hearing some of the news of when we're hearing some of the news that Catelyn is hearing that her sons are dead, one of the first things she thinks of is the direwolves, right? Like mm-hmm. how yeah. Sansa and Arya lost theirs, and she told them to keep them close. Then she starts thinking about she just wants her daughters back, and they're talking about like Brienne's talking about how she would, you know, like to. Wouldn't it be great to have the Lannisters' heads on a spike, right? To kill them and all this stuff. And Catelyn's starting to saying like she would like to see that. And there's a lot of this chapter for me is sort of the chapter where it's like when you think of what Lady Stoneheart will become, it's mm-hmm. almost like even if Stoneheart didn't happen, this is sort of the chapter where it's like she's started to make that shift into just yeah. being a vengeful. Obviously, given the circumstances, it's understandable, but you can see her psyche start to slowly tilt in that direction.
Yeah, and one of the things that does it is it's these people that she trusted, you know, because like Littlefinger with the dagger later on, Theon, right? Theon was someone who sat at her table and he's the one who's done this. And then the betrayal later on at the Red Wedding, all of these things are done by people near and dear and like close to her. So yeah, she becomes almost unhinged. She's starting to really, be depressed and is despairing. I mean, it is so wild. It's such a sad kind of story and arc, and you totally see how that character, Lady Stoneheart is created and how that's all she has left at the end, especially after the Red Wedding. I mean, that's why I'm Team Stoneheart. You know, I hate sick of the phrase, sick of the Lannisters. I mean, all of their mistreatment and stuff is just wild. You know, the other thing that you brought up, the direwolves, and she does oftentimes, I mean, we know that she's going to become a character who will be a part of the supernatural element, right? And it's interesting that all along the way, she really focuses and emphasizes the supernatural and like the direwolves and the connection to them. So I just thought that, you know, was interesting, has always been interesting with Catelyn. Because House Tully doesn't always feel like that magical kind of, like that there's a lot of connections to a magical element or a supernatural element, even though they're right there on the Riverlands where we know the Children of the Forest populated and there's a lot, you know, a lot of good history, a lot of rich history there. But yeah, it's a start to the path towards Lady Stoneheart.
Yeah. Yeah, just like you said, when she's talking about how it's Theon, it's just one thing after another. And there's also, you know, Hoster Tully is dying. Like, everything's all sort of happening. And these batch of chapters with her at River Run, you can just see everything's, like, slowly out of her control. Remember, a few chapters ago, she stopped to pray, right? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like she feels, it's almost like now even the faith are no longer with you, right? To keep she's only praying to keep her family safe, and that she thinks isn't happening. Actually, they are all safe. She just doesn't know it. They're at least all alive. And so yeah, it's just this slow sort of descent into madness, which I think when helps her become sort of Lady Stoneheart when she does eventually die and is brought back.
Yeah. And now she's reaching towards this desperation. She's got this idea that I'm going to go. I mean, really, her company, she at one point tries to send Brienne away just to kind of say, hey, you don't want to be with me. I'm miserable right now. Go enjoy all this celebration and these things that are happening because they're rooting for Rob. Edmure's on his way back. Go enjoy that. She doesn't. She's also kind of in mourning and still thinking about Renly and the loss there and what's going to become of her. And Jaime Lannister is captured and he is down in the cells. So let's go down. Let's let this miserable group of people, this trio, get together and just be miserable together is really what happens. And she sent earlier Jaime some wine, right? And so he's pretty well drunk and maybe loosened up, and she wants to go question him. She feels like she has to just be, I think, just doing something. What can I do now to save and protect or preserve my brother and my son and my remaining family members? So my daughters, right? Like Sansa and Arya. What can I do? I need to do whatever I can to make this happen. At the start of this chapter, the only person who knows that she tells, I think it was the Septon, and then Brienne knows as well. She tells her about it. So no one really knows.
Yeah.
Right. And it's once they find it's a real immediate reaction. I think had other people known, they would have kept a close eye on her. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah. It's one of the, I'm looking at the A Song of Ice and it's a really good the A Song of Ice and Fire reread Reddit because you can see what people are saying. And again, I really like this because you can see people going through the chapter before the show came out. So this was from just Tacos is his Reddit name. But so I think he makes a really good sort of point about this, and he says, you know, as my reread goes on, I'm becoming more and more aware of how different each chapter is. Just everything he's sort of picking up as he's going on. He's like, it's very clear to me in this chapter, the whole castle is cheering, celebrating, drinking, but we barely get a glimpse of it. A cheer sneaks through here and there, a love song here and there. Meanwhile, Kat is living in shadows because her heart is gone and she cannot feel joy. She literally dines in shadows. She moves alone through the empty castle. She is one of two who know of Bran and Rickon. She's the only one to consider that her father is barely alive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sums up really well. And yeah, she's the one. Nobody else knows that information. And then yeah, Hoster Tully is dying, and a lot of people just they're not We just don't hear it from like the guard, you know, just the random soldiers and everything. We don't get it. So it seems like she's bearing that burden alone.
Yeah, for sure. And that's I'm glad you read that, because all of the shadow play and all of the darkness and just her state of mind. Yeah, it really helps you kind of see, you know, it emphasizes that foreshadowing that's gonna happen later on. And actually, that's why I think a lot of times when we do these rereads, it is important to pay attention to little things like that. I mean, to know where these characters are gonna go now and then look back and say, okay, we can see all the stuff for Lady Stoneheart here. But that's why you and I love doing Winds of Winter predictions and looking forward, because when there are little references like the one I'm gonna bring up at the end of this episode, they're little, they're just hinted at, and they're just word choice that's thrown in around these characters, but it's done purposefully, right? It's done for a reason, because the author knows where we're going. And even if it's just the tone or the mood or word choice or whatever, it matters. And mm-hmm. Yeah, she's in a really miserable state.
Yeah. Now, so as we move forward, this actually is, because I think the show does a great job of blurring our mind of how we out of what we actually get of Jamie in the books. Because remember, in the books, especially A Game of Thrones, there's barely any Jamie Lannister. I mean, so he's like a super villain. There's that really the scene in the show. I like that it's there, especially because us book readers will come to appreciate Jamie more by the time we see that scene. There's a scene where Ned is talking to Jaime Lannister, and he's sort of saying, like, you know, I was here when your brothers died. And it seems sort of sincere when he says it in the show. And then Ned's like, is that really what you tell yourself? Is that what you tell yourself? Kind of a thing, like, tells him off. But you don't get that in the books. So Jamie just feels like a villain. So now we're actually getting some Jamie Lannister. Like, this is our first real insight to who he actually is as a character. And it's like, okay, well, maybe this guy isn't as bad as we thought. And then remember, it's the next book starts off with like a Jamie chapter. It's like right there. And so this is our first insight to this guy. And you're seeing, well, Tyrion isn't as bad as we thought. Mm-hmm. You know, because, oh, he's a Lannister, but Tyrion, he seems okay. And now we're getting some of Jaime saying, you know, like, the Mad King was a total tyrant. Yeah, right. I killed him. Like, I mean, it's the scene with Brienne is way better, because you get the full detail of the whole event. But here he's saying, you know, Aerys was the Mad King.
Yeah.
He burned your husband's family alive. I mean,
yeah, yes, exactly. And he actually in this chapter brings up, Hightower, Gerald Hightower, mm-hmm. And who was I think Lord Commander of the Kingsguard during that time. And he said, you know what? I mean, essentially, just to sum it up for you guys, no one says diddly squat about him standing by and watching the trial by combat, right, that Lord Stark had to go through with the flames. You know what I mean? He demands trial by combat, and Aerys says, all right, my champion's the flames. Have at it. I'm going to burn you alive. Bring out the wildfire. Like, and the Lord Commander of the Kingsguard at the time says to Jaime, still, you know, like, it's not your job is not to judge the king, it's to protect the king. And he's known as one of the greatest, you know, members of the Kingsguard, like, ever, like right there with Sir Arthur Dayne and everyone else. I mean, these guys are epic, right? But they stood by and let these terrible things go on around the Mad King. So is Jaime better than them because he saw what they couldn't see? He saw through the many lies that are, like, which vow do you keep? You're right. The whole Brienne conversation is amazing when he has it later on. Like, which promises do you keep? And I just read a Jaime chapter where he challenges the current members of the Kingsguard. And it's epic. Right. He's thinking back
to,
like,
about that in our Raven, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Yeah, no, it's... It's this is a great chapter in terms of getting sort of insight, and I like that we get the opposing sort of viewpoints, really, you know, because everything, all of our story has been so Stark focused, and then it's beginning. Now we get Jaime's side of the story, somebody who we've only seen as a villain. It's actually why I really appreciate the Cersei chapters that will be coming up in the next books as well, because then you really get to see everybody's side of the story. And who knows? Maybe Jaime will have full redemption in the books, right? Yeah. Maybe he won't go back to Cersei like he did in the show. We don't know. He might be the one who kills her. Valonqar prophecy could still happen.
That yes, man. There are people. Some of the stuff we're going to bring up later today is basically all about Jaime's arc. And so, really, what I think is important, and what George likes to do, and we talked to our friend Sir Jimmy about this, he likes to write about that conflict, that inner conflict, the heart kind of in conflict with itself. You know what I mean? And you're as the reader, you start off hating this guy. He flat out admits in this chapter that he shoved a little boy out the window to kill him, so that way he and his sister could continue on. You know what I mean? Like, and there'd be no witnesses. And the things you do for love. That's what he did.
Right.
So he admits to these things. I think really though, I think Jaime originally probably was. I don't know. Okay. Let me bring up something here. So later on, when Jaime comes back after his, I'm going to jump ahead. This is a reread, so we're allowed to do this, folks. Just remember, all right? So we'll jump ahead here. All right. Jaime's hand is cut off. He comes back, and Loras Tyrell is sitting across from him, and he's a little prick. A little prick, okay? And literally, Jaime is sitting there looking at him saying, "That was me. I was like this guy. Was I that arrogant? Was I like that?" And he's like reflecting in his older age, and now that he's lost his hand and realizing that he's Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, he's saying, "I can't believe that I was like that." But still, I think back when he was serving under the Mad King, I think he probably had more of, you know, when you're younger, you have those, I don't know, you haven't gone through a whole lot, you haven't experienced the world, and you're more likely to be optimistic and think like, just to kind of be, you know, believe in chivalry and all that kind of stuff, right? So I think the way he behaves at the beginning of Game of Thrones goes, the reason he is that way is has to do with everything that happened to him being called the Kingslayer for years. When he looks in the white book and he sees, this is all you wrote about me? I'm way more than this. What about my tourneys? What about all these other things? He looks at his book, and by the way, life lesson here, we all need to go look at our book and think about, you know, what can we add to it tomorrow, right? Or today, I should say. So, you know, he's thinking about that and reflecting, and it's so cool to be drawn towards a character like that and say, yes, I want to rally behind this guy. Like, we're sitting here later on in the Storm of Swords saying, I hope he learns how to fight with his left hand and he can take on anyone in Westeros. We hated this guy to start with, and this is now who Catelyn is going to put her trust in. You know, spoiler, right? At the end of this, she calls for Brienne's sword, but really we know what's going to happen. There's gonna be some promising, and there's gonna be some you know, back and forth, some more words and vows, oaths sworn by Jaime to Catelyn. But yeah, man, it's just kind of wild to see Jaime develop and change. And that's, George loves to do that, I think, with his reader, is to say, I'm gonna plant a guy that you're gonna hate, but I watch what I'm gonna do. And you're going to come around and love this guy by the end. And we do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, keep in mind, I still like, I'll still throw out the possibility. Jaime could still totally, he is a total super candidate to be like Azor Ahai and ultimately be the guy, right? Mm-hmm. Will he kill the Night King, right? The Kingslayer. Remember, for the a long time we thought the Kingslayer. And then it's also like you kill Nyssa, then you stab them. Remember, to create Lightbringer, they stabbed it in the heart of a lion. Uh-huh. He could do both at once. Right? He could do both at once. Like, what if he has to kill Cersei? Because she's going to blow up King's Landing because the White Walkers are there. You know, there's God. Still all of that stuff, all of those crazy season 8 theories we had can still totally happen in the books, right?
Yeah.
Maybe he will be. Maybe he will kill the Night's King, right? If we get something like that. And then remember, one of the things they do have at the end of the show, I mean, it's Euron fights Jaime. Mm-hmm. Jaime kills Euron Greyjoy.
Yeah.
Now, if that is something where George says, yeah, oh, and then Euron is going to be like a bad guy at the very end. He's going to be one of those like final villains. And then he and Jaime will fight and Jaime kills him.
Yeah.
Well, if Jaime kills the Euron we have in the books, well, that in itself is going to be epic.
Yeah, that's huge. That's huge. And that's the thing is that I love the chapter that I'm in with Jaime right now, where he's reading back on the likes of Sir Arthur Dayne and Sir Barristan Selmy, Gerald Hightower. He goes through them, and then you can go back even further, and you can go back to even Sir Criston Cole and some of those guys who were like, they could command a force. The things that they did were just so epic. And Jaime's looking at that book going, I don't even have my sword hand anymore. And we're sitting here going to George, please let this be the guy who we rally around his left hand or his wisdom or whatever, his wit, because he's also a very savvy commander. And to think, could he be a guy who, because he has that kind of demeanor that he could stand. Could you imagine him standing across from Euron Greyjoy and just taking no crap from him? I mean, that would be
one of the coolest moments. One of my favorite moments I remember was, I think it was, what is this? Is it season 6 when this all happens? Yeah, I think it's season 6. Remember when we saw the trailer? When we saw the trailer for season 6, one of the shots I think is Jaime riding up to the steps of the the High Sept, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With like an army. Like, I want Cersei, you know. Like, oh, it's on.
Okay. It's on.
And then Tommen's there. So that's going to be interesting, because right where he's at in the books, he's way far away from that. A lot of that stuff hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The stuff with the septum and the faith. Right. But I do think that's totally still possible.
Yeah. This is all tying into my Kettle Black theory. It's so cool that you're bringing these things up, because
we're going to talk about it. Yeah.
Because there's a lot more that can happen. His arc, he's tied. Just like it was, he's a twin. His twin is Cersei. He is tied to her, and their fates are interwoven, just as they were in the womb. And so George is going to bring us back there. He takes them far away from each other physically and like even emotionally and everything else. But ultimately, just like we saw in the show, they will come back together in the end. Now, I don't know if it's going to go the same way, like if they're going to just die there under King's Landing, or what the heck's going to happen. Is he going to kill? I don't think that's going to be anywhere close to being the same, but yeah, we'll see. we just dove down and did like a Jaime Lannister Winds of Winter predictions.
Well, that's okay, because it's part of this chapter. But as I think we're going to continue on a little bit here and talk a little bit about Osmond Kettleblack. And some of the things that might happen to this family, the Kettle Black family, in potentially Winds of Winter.
Yeah, so let's give a little context here for folks. Just if you've read the series, you've heard the name Kettle Black just too many times, right? I mean, we hear there are three of them. No, excuse me, there are four of them. Littlefinger has their father working for him, Oswald Kettle Black. And who are they? You know, like that we don't know really where they come from. We're not really sure. We know that they work for Littlefinger, or I'm sorry, do they work for Cersei or Tyrion, or who is it that's backing them? So they're an interesting group, and I kind of wanted, this is a Sir Ezra just rabbit hole that we were on, and this is what kind of happens. We get a little crazy, and I thought I would just start making some connections. So was reading about Jaime. And I was reading about him dealing with the White Book and thinking about the Kingsguard and thinking about all these epic things. And he starts to reflect on his life. And anytime I'm reading something now in this reread, I start to think, okay, well, where is his arc going to go? And I start to interpret that chapter I'm reading, and I try to use it towards a Winds of Winter theory or prediction. And this one's a little crazy, but I'm going to go with it. So was it Tyrion? Didn't Tyrion say that she was fucking Osmond Kettleblack? I mean,
yeah,
I'm pretty sure he says so. Like, it's pretty well known.
Osmond Kettleblack and Moonboy.
Was that true as well? You know, like, so there's just the Kettleblacks have gotten in these positions of power. You know, Osmond Kettleblack is a nobody. Like, when he's questioned by Jaime and he wants to know, like, where did you get your knighthood? Where did you serve? Osmond doesn't have really good responses for him. And Jaime calls into question his knighthood. But yet, this is a guy who is here in King's Landing. He has risen all the way to be a member of the Kingsguard. And I just think that is wild. I think, and I forget which one it is, one of the other Kettleblacks is like the head of Cersei's guard, right? The Lannister household guard. And yeah, with the youngest one, she's making all sorts of plots to, she's using him to kind of help her conspire against Margaery Tyrell. And she's going to send him on a mission to the wall, you know, to kill Jon Snow. There's just some wild stuff happening with the Kettleblacks. And when you first start a Game of Thrones and you're working your way through, you're kind of like, all right, these are just, you know, what's a sellsword family, a couple brothers, their father, now we learn, is working for Littlefinger, you know, whatever. But I made an interesting connection, and it's far-fetched, but I think I want it to be something that you guys think about. Leave us a comment, send us a raven, what have you. Jaime, when he's reflecting about the great deeds of his brothers that wear the white cloak, the Kingsguard, he thinks back to a time, I think it's, he's thinking about Ser Barristan Selmy, and he's thinking about Ser Arthur Dayne. So here it is. I'm going to read it for you guys. He reflects on a particular character called the Smiling Knight. Okay. Let's see here. So, let's see. His life seemed a rather scant and mingy thing. Ser Barristan could have recorded a few of the other tourneys and victories at least. So he's reflecting, thinking like, why is there not more in my book, right? Ser Gerald might have written a few more words about the deeds he had performed when Ser Arthur Dayne broke the Kingswood Brotherhood. So this is where we're focused at, the Kingswood Brotherhood. He had saved Lord Sumner's life as Big Belly Ben was about to smash his head in. And that was Lord Sumner was the one who he squired under. So let's see. There is a fight that breaks out with an individual called the Smiling Knight, who was a madman. Okay. Jaime is proud of himself, Sir Matt, because he holds his own against the Smiling Knight. All right. Now, this is just a kind of a loose connection here, but he holds his own. He didn't finish that fight. I feel like there's unfinished business there or whatever. It's Ser Arthur Dayne who comes in with the Sword of the Morning and who does fight the Smiling Knight and has to kind of take over. And Ser Arthur Dayne is coming in there. And they're fighting. It's this epic thing. And Jaime reflects on that. Okay. But I feel like he's this individual that Jaime held his own, and he was happy that he did. He felt like that should have been something that was worthy of mentioning. Like that he fought the Smiling Knight. The Smiling Knight is also known as the Robber Knight, okay? And so my connection to Osmond Kettleblack here is that he is this knight that is essentially robbing Cersei from him. He's robbing Cersei away from Jaime, taking her further and further away, especially now that he's lost his hand. So this is, again, kind of a Storm of Swords, Feast for Crows, Dance of Dragons situation. But If you look, and there is literally tons of evidence, and people might think this is a stretch, but I think it's just kind of cool. Let's see, Sir Osmond. Anytime that he's mentioned, he's smiling. He is smiling, Sir Matt. Like, he is constantly, he's always there with a ready smile. So Sansa is there. This is Sansa 6 in A Clash of Kings. Sir Osmond and his brothers had become great favorites about the castle. They were always ready with a smile and a jest. Okay. Let's see. Tyrion, as he's looking at Sir Osmond, said that he was formidable enough that he stood 6 feet and 6 inches, right? He's got this hooked nose, bushy eyebrows. He's got this brown beard that gave his face a fierce aspect so long as he did not smile. Why even throw that in there, okay? Sir Osmond Kettleblack managed a smile when he saw Tyrion waddling towards him, feeling strong. My lord, is a question he asked him. He says, let's see, at the very end, so now back to A Storm of Swords when in Jaime, I think it's 8, he is talking about the Smiling Knight and the Robber Knight, and he's reflecting on that right before his new brothers walk in. And at the very end of this little passage here, yeah, so here we go. Yes, the Smiling Knight. So it was, they were all in their graves now. So speaking about Sir Arthur Dayne and the other members of the Kingsguard, the Sword of the Morning and the Smiling Knight, the White Bull and Prince Lewin, Sir Oswell went and his Black Humor, Ernest John Derry, and so on, and his Kingswood Brotherhood, bluff old Sumner Craycall. And me, that boy I was, when did he die, I wonder? When I donned the white cloak, when I opened Aerys' throat, that boy had wanted to be Sir Arthur Dayne, but someplace along the way, he had become the Smiling Knight instead. So there's just a lot of him thinking about himself as the Smiling Knight when he wants to be Sir Arthur Dayne. I think that Jaime's arc is going to take him to a point where he once was a squire that fought the Smiling Knight and he couldn't win. And it took the likes of Sir Arthur Dayne to beat the Smiling Knight. I think he'll face the Smiling Knight once again, left-handed, and that Smiling Knight will probably be the Kettleblack. It'll be Osmond Kettleblack, a member of the Kingsguard. Like, he'll have to become almost as good, or he'll have to be, you know, rise to that level that Sir Arthur Dayne was to beat Sir Osmond Kettleblack. And I just thought that was kind of cool. At the end of that, when he heard the door open, he closed the white book and stood to receive his sworn brothers. Sir Osmond Kettleblack was the first to arrive. He gave Jaime a grin as if they were old brothers in arms, right? So, and numerous times when Sir Osmond walks in and meets Jaime, he's grinning. There's another time where he meets him as an old friend. Let's see if I can find that. Yeah. Okay, yeah, Sir Osmond came trotting back to her. Yeah, when they're describing his other brothers, they talk about them having a scowl versus a smile. I don't know. I mean, is it just kind of like the Smiling Knight is important to Jaime?
No, it's...
And then you have a knight around him who is smiling, who is a robber, who is stealing Cersei. And I just... You know, wonder if there's a more of a connection there. Any thoughts?
No, I agree with you 100%. It's great. It's definitely interesting that's something that caught your attention, because those are the themes and those are the things that George Martin will write into his books, and that's how he writes his characters. It's tons of these tiny, small, little the smallest of details that show up time and time again are lead to the biggest of secrets. Right. And the biggest events. And this is, I think maybe you're right. This could be one of them.
Well, in numerous times. So from that point, from that meeting moving forward, so Jaime will notice the proximity, like Osmond Kettleblack is kept so close to Cersei. She puts her arm around him. There's questions of manhood, like he's becoming more and more jealous of this individual. And I just kind of see, I'm almost foreseeing that this might be someone who, depending on how the trial shapes out, you still have a long way to go, right? Like, we don't even know if the Kettleblacks are going to make it. I mean, they're imprisoned. I think two of them are imprisoned by Qyburn and one by the Faith. And will they even make it? Some people have predicted that Cersei, even if she gets out of all of this, or that she might not stay in King's Landing. You know, it could be that young Griff moves into, or Aegon, True Aegon. Some people like to call him Fagon. I don't know what's up with that. But may right. come to King's Landing and may force her out. Well, who has she been leaning on? I think if Osmond Kettleblack is still alive, that would be someone who she would want to take with her. If Qyburn's there, that's awesome. You know, then she'll be going back to Casterly Rock. Some people have speculated that the Kettle Blacks may be furious with her afterwards and may want to try to assassinate her, and that might be at a request from Littlefinger. Ultimately, they work for Littlefinger. Has Osmond gotten some grand notion that he's a member of the Kingsguard? Is he still not someone who can be bought by Littlefinger? But could he be used against Cersei and go after her and try to assassinate her in some way? Would that then force Jaime to step in and save his sister? You know, it's just thoughts. I just kind of foresee like those two possibly coming together in some way. There's tons of tension between them. And then when I found the connection between Smiling and the Smiling Knight and Jaime wanting to not be the Smiling Knight, but to be Sir Arthur Dayne, who defeated the Smiling Knight, and for that to be written in his white book, I thought there might be something there. There might be.
Oh, that is a very, very good point. That is a very, very cool, interesting connection that you found. Because again, as I said, those are the details. Those are the things that George will write. Right?
It could be small. It could be. Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's, you and I were talking. You and I were talking the other day about maybe the idea of Cersei being the one to sort of kill Osmond Kettle Black. Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about how in the show we see when the Sept of Baelor is about to get blown up, it's Lancel Lannister. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's ultimately down there, and right, he gets stabbed and then he drops the torch, and we were talking about maybe the possibility of it being Osmond Kettle Black, right? That's down there, and she's gonna like get rid of him, because remember, Kevin Lannister is. And you and I we're working on maybe doing another video just on his death, because it changes everything. to be completely honest, because Kevin Lannister is somebody who's killed right when the Sept of Baelor blows up. So, but that was before you had made this connection here, the sort of Smiling Knight laughing, you know, him as well. Wow, I don't know. Now I'm totally backtracking my thoughts on maybe it would be Cersei that would get rid of them, right? Just as kind of like, I don't need them around anymore. I used them for what I needed. But now I think I am more on the line of it's going to be Jaime. Now remember in the show, the Mountain almost like threatens to kill Jaime. Like he steps in front and Cersei doesn't have. Remember that's kind of like their big break. Yeah. Maybe instead of the Mountain. Because I think Clegane Bowl is likely to happen sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at like the Gravedigger,
yeah,
and if Cersei has to go on trial, maybe Jaime doesn't fight, and so she uses the Mountain, and then you know the Gravedigger, supposedly the Hound, is still alive. It's sort of working at this like monastery. What if they say we have somebody, and then that we get Clegane Bowl earlier? Then if you do get a sort of break like we saw in the show with Cersei and Jaime where they split, maybe it's Osmond Kettle Black who is gonna fight Jaime, and then Jaime kills him.
Yeah. So I remember you brought that point earlier in the reread. You were talking about Euron, and in the show he's the one who marries and is next to Cersei, right? I think it's again. They simplified all of that in the show, but Jaime does confront someone who is by Cersei's side. So if you take that idea and you say, who, if it's not Euron, who is the guy that could be next to Cersei? Kettle Black is an option. I mean, Osmond Kettle Black, if he makes it out and she brings him along or whatever, because I think she's really pissed. I forget which Kettle Black brother. It was the one who was tortured by the Faith. It was the youngest one, I think, because he broke and basically said, she told me to lie. So Sir Osmond, who she's closest with, who's the oldest and who is a member of the Kingsguard and closer to her, she has a better relationship with, I believe. And that might be someone who she would keep around her. So just going based off the show there, possibly Jaime could interact with him. She could say, you weren't here for me, right? I had to use the Mountain in my trial by combat. Thankfully, I got out of that, or there was some weird situation where it didn't work out, but I blew up the Sept of Baelor. And, you know, from all that, I ran away with Sir Osmond, and, you know, and then now Jaime's facing him. I think some of the kettleblacks probably will die. I just don't. Again, there's three of them. Not really sure how that's all going to shape out. Who's going to be at the Sept? Who's not going to be? You know what is Kyburn happens. Doing to them?
If the Sept of Baelor does, get blown up in the show, yeah. Because then the other person you kind of have to take in consideration is Bronn. Because Bronn's storyline towards the end of the Game of Thrones is like a total wash, because the actor Lena Headey and Jerome Flynn,
yeah,
like there was rumors that I'm pulling it up now, and it looks like they've kind of rebuffed that a little bit and said no, that's not the case, but we don't know, right?
Right. Yeah.
But so there were rumors for a long time that they didn't even want to be on scenes together. And then we see Bronn kind of showing up at the end, right, with the crossbow, like, hey, you guys are going to do stuff. So who knows? That could be another person where maybe it's Bronn and Jaime that fight or something like that, and that would replace maybe an Osmond Kettleblack or something like that. But no, I think I'm more in line now that I think with, since you brought up all that stuff about the Smiling Knight and all those connections there, I think it's more likely that Clegane Bowl happens earlier, which moves the Mountain and the Hound. I think they'll probably just kill each other off screen, maybe, or off page, off book. And then the scene where we saw Jaime and Cersei sort of clash, where the Mountain stepped in, maybe that is Osmond Kettleblack, and maybe that's when that fight takes place.
Yeah. Let me give you one more situation, because this is not over, right? So the Kettleblacks are not a large part of this. I mean, they're around, they're referenced quite a bit. But if you got to a point in Winds of Winter where Jaime was again reflecting on Sir Arthur Dayne and his fight, and how he was happy that he held his own against the Smiling Knight. If he continues to reflect in any way, shape, or form on the Smiling Knight or that duel with Sir Arthur Dayne, and Osmond Kettleblack is nearby smiling, I just think there's room to make a connection there, and I think, you know, it could bear out. It could be important. It's one of his most distinguishing features. Now all of the brothers smile, but it seems as if Osmond is the one who is, I think it's the middle brother that doesn't smile, that scowls more than he smiles. And then the youngest one has he has some scars, I think, some across his face or whatever, and it's Osmond again who has that easy smile. So, you know, take it for what you will, friends. I mean, I would love to get some people's thoughts, and I literally just did, Matt knows this, I probably did like, I don't know what, 30 minutes just like looking through. I mean, I haven't really thought this through entirely, but I just kept finding those connections, and I thought, it's something new, something a little different. Thought we'd give it a go and see what you guys think. So,
yeah, absolutely. So, guys, yeah, leave us a comment. Let us know.
Yeah.
All right. With that, I think that is our show for today. Man, we are flying through this book. We are almost done.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm happy for us to like really get into A Storm of Swords, because there's so many more connections, and our conversations will take us down, I think, way more rabbit holes than they do in this book, because we just know too much information from that book that we always want to lean into those conversations, and we're not quite there yet. So I can't wait for that.
The Storm of Swords is my favorite. I think it's the best book of the five.
Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. I'm blitzing through it right now, and I'm kind of doing like a double reread. Like I'm going chapter by chapter here, but I get off of our podcast, and I'll, in the morning when I head back to work, boom, man, I'm picking right back up there, and I'll get through 3 to 4 chapters. It's just, I'm flying through it.
Yeah, you know. And you're right. It does. I remember the iTunes comment we got where somebody said, it was a nice, it was a 4-star review, but he said we talked about the same people a lot, and I was like, well, that's kind of because where we're at, right? But really, A Clash of Kings, now that, you know, we get a little more Theon, we get a little more Davos, but next book is where everything just really, it's like the doors are open, right? Because with the exception of like young Griff, I mean, everybody, I mean, we get to start talking about the Ghost of Highheart. We get to talk about more of the Tyrells. We get to talk, you know, Arya and the Hound. I mean, it's all there.
Right. Oh yeah. It's going to be exciting. And I'm hoping to get there. Probably, we think by the end of the summer we'll be there, I think, right?
Yeah, we're on how many chapters? I don't have it pulled up here.
I think we're on chapter 56. So we've got, you know,
there. Let me. I got it pulled up here. There's 69 chapters, and we're on 56 Theon 5. We're done with Catelyn. That was our last Catelyn chapter. So we kind of go back and forth here, and we're. This is pretty much gonna be the Battle of the Blackwater that's happening. Just. Next, I mean, you have this Theon chapter, but then it's Sansa Davos, Tyrion Sansa. Then we get the one Daenerys chapter that always breaks up everything. And then it's Arya Sansa, Theon, Tyrion, Jon, Bran. So that little end part there where Bran's gonna, all right, we're gonna go north and see what happens. So,
yeah,
to end it, but yeah, exciting.
Yeah, for sure, man. I'm actually, I think this summer too. By the way, I only have like friends. I don't know if I've mentioned this in a bit. Sir Ezra's taking a new path, so if you wouldn't mind subscribing to YouTube and helping us out there, I'd appreciate it. Like, I am definitely a hedge knight here, and I may pledge my sword. Just who knows where to any of you who will support us over on YouTube or support us over on Patreon. So we're looking at doubling down on some content on YouTube. And Sir Matt and I, he knows I have a vacation coming up in the summertime. So we're going to be, I think we tear through a lot of these Clash of Kings chapters early summer, get those, you know, locked up or whatever.
Those will be out. They'll be ahead. We'll be, yeah.
Yeah. So that's exciting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, with that, we want to thank you for playing the Game of Thrones. In our next episode, we will be discussing Chapter 56, Theon 5 of A Clash of Kings.
Absolutely. If you like our podcast, don't forget to subscribe, like us, write a review, leave a comment, or send us a raven at btkcast@gmail.com.
We will see you in a week. And remember that winter is coming.